Hello and welcome to The Bunker, your need to know on news and politics 7 days a week. I'm Dorian Linsky. My guest today is Adam Biles. Adam is literary director at Shakespeare & Company in Paris, aka the best bookshop in the world. And some of the books he stocks are his own. He published his first novel, Feeding Time, in 2016, and his new one, Beast of England, is out now. It's both a sequel to and a reimagining of George Orwell's 1945 masterpiece, Animal Farm, using the farmyard allegory to comment on more recent political developments. Hi, Adam. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
So it struck me that Orwell was writing about Russian politics from England using an English setting.
Yeah.
You're writing in this largely, not exclusively, about UK politics from your base in Paris, where I believe you've been for 18 years?
Yes.
What was it like watching the mayhem of the last few years in your home country from a distance?
It was different depending on which years we're talking about, because between, well, when I first moved out to Paris in 2005 and up until 2018, I would go back quite regularly.
Right.
I'd go back every 3 or 4 months to the town that I grew up, which is Bournemouth. And one thing I noticed, particularly after the financial crisis and after austerity really kicked in, was that each time I went back, I would notice another shop on the high street boarded up, or, you know, another part of the railway station crumbling down and kind of fenced off. And when I would talk about this with family still who were still in the town, they would sort of say, oh, yeah, that's true. But I think because I wasn't going back so frequently, it's almost a little bit like the frog in the water that's slowly boiling. That sort of I would have a sense of the town and the country generally kind of going to the dogs. And people who were there, they shared that sense, but not in quite such a dramatic way. And then the pandemic struck. And in fact, for different reasons, I hadn't been back to Bournemouth much in 2019. And then the pandemic struck. And so by the time I started writing this book, which was in early 2021, I'd actually been out of the UK for the longest period in my life, which was close to 2 years. And that provoked another kind of sentiment, which was sadness and frustration, I guess. Sadness at what I saw was happening, both with Brexit, the disaster that was politically and socially, and then with the pandemic and the way that the pandemic in a weird sort of way was used a little bit to cover up the disaster of Brexit, and then added its whole own sort of layer of sort of mismanagement and incompetence and corruption on top of that. And the frustration was that I felt like I couldn't do anything about it from that distance. Now, honestly, I don't know what I would have done if I was here. And I think a lot of my friends and family here felt a similar frustration and similarly impotent. But that was one of, I guess, the driving forces behind this book.
Because for those who don't know, Orwell's work fell out of copyright in the UK in January 2021, making a book like this possible. But are you saying that the moral and emotional impulse rather than the literary impulse was that experience during the pandemic?
Yeah, I would say so. Like, literary impulse is always difficult to talk about because it's you're never really sure where it comes from. I think often of the novelist Robertson Davies, who said, I don't get my ideas get me. So once the idea had come for writing a sequel to Animal Farm, I didn't think too much about the literary side of it. But I came across this quote from Orwell. I think it was in his, I may be getting this wrong, but I think it was in the preface to the Ukrainian edition of Animal Farm, where he says that that was the first time with this book he fused his political purpose and his artistic purpose. And I just thought that was a really interesting turn of phrase, particularly not like a political point or a political message, but a political purpose, which to me implies that not only did Orwell want to sort of convey ideas with this book, but he also wanted this book to have an effect. And that was something which, yeah, really caught my attention and really made me think, okay, maybe books in some sort of limited way can still have a political effect.
And presumably because of his real anger and moral purpose, you know, you needed your own. Because I could imagine a rather sort of glib, almost spitting image version of Animal Farm with you know, modern politicians being represented. But because Orwell was like determined to write this, determined to get his message across, determined to get it published despite all the difficulties, then almost in order to do something like this, you had to have that genuine outrage.
Yes. Yeah. I think I had to have the genuine outrage and also the genuine sense of I was making a moral gesture with this book.
Right.
Which is, I think Orwell is one of those writers who is an inherently moral writer. And by which I mean, I don't think that he's necessarily always conveying amoral. Like, I think it's debatable whether there is a specific moral to Animal Farm, but the writing of the book itself is a moral act for him. And not just Animal Farm, but I think his essays too, I think 1984. And I don't think that's particularly common among writers. Mm. The only other sort of major 20th century writer who I would say was a distinctly moral writer and for whom writing was a moral act is probably Albert Camus. And you find that in that sort of drive in his work. And, you know, I'm not saying that I have quite the same, certainly the same capacity as Orwell or Camus to realize this moral act or to bring it, you know, bring it to fruition. But I found that inspiring. I thought that in this context where a lot of immoral, or what I saw as immoral acts were underway, that could be the way that I could potentially have an impact.
And Orwell and Camus were meant to meet up in Paris shortly before Animal Farm came out.
Oh, right.
But Camus was ill.
Huh.
And so they never met, which is a shame because yeah. I think you could probably make a movie
yeah.
around a kind of
maybe that'll be the next
coffee
book.
between those two. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Animal Farm is both satire and propaganda, and its message is really clear. And Orwell didn't disguise that. He was quite happy for copies to be distributed in Eastern Europe, you know, where he thought that his point would be really urgent. Does the mess of democratic politics, even in the populist era, make that kind of direct hit more difficult? Because he's almost like, you know, a plague on Stalinism. Mm-hmm. You can't sort of denounce, I mean, one could, but I don't think you are denouncing democracy in the same way.
I think that it's much more complex. I mean, one of the things that certain reviews of the book have cited, I think fairly, is that compared to Orwell's story, which is in some sense very pure and very short, Beasts yeah. of England is much more, there's a lot more threads, there's a lot more stories, and perhaps sometimes there can be elements of confusion about what exactly is going on when. And I think that's a perfectly legitimate thing to say about the book. My sort of justification for that is, you know, have you seen recent politics? Like, there's not just sort of one thread you can understand, one particular target you can go after. And you said, like, for Orwell, it was a plague on Russia. A little bit for me when I started writing this book. Well, not right at the start, it was sort of a plague on, you know, the Brexiteers, plague on Johnson, plague on the right wing. Very quickly, as I started piecing together what was going to be my allegory, my feeling really became like a plague on all of your houses, like really,
really?
Like across the board. And that dissipated in a certain way as the book went on. But I expected to come at it with from a certain, you know, what I consider my sort of political home, which would be sort of broadly center left with certain caveats. And found myself, as I was tracing the threads of this particular book, getting frustrated with maybe not with everyone equally, but with certainly with everyone.
Well, Animal Farm, as people will know, probably a lot of listeners will have studied it at school. Mm-hmm. Like of all the classic novels, novellas in English, it's like it is one of the easiest to read.
Yes.
And it's a very disciplined allegory of Soviet Russia. You can make a one-to-one comparison between almost every character and events. Mm-hmm. And Napoleon the Pig is Stalin, Boxer the Horse is the exploited worker, and so on.
Yeah.
Now, Beasts of England, there were times when I was very confident that I'd identified the politician that an animal was representing. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes I became less sure. Uh-huh. So if I think a certain character represents Boris Johnson or uh-huh. Nigel Farage or Jeremy Corbyn, am I wrong? You know, and that actually they're all sort of composites to some extent. Or is it that you, at this stage of publication mm-hmm. anyway, as the author, don't want to lay it out and give everybody a key, but there sort of is a key in your head. You know?
I think it's a little bit more complicated than that. I think one of the things that is interesting about Animal Farm is that it's very specific to the Russian Revolution in a way. Like, the characters do map on more or less precisely, and the events, you know, right up to the fact that the final scene, which Orwell said he intended to basically mirror the Tehran conference. Yeah. And yet in somehow it transcends those events too and sort of tells a a bigger truth in some way, and it touches people. I mean, there's that wonderful moment in Martin Amis's Money where John Self is reading Animal Farm. He's saying, this book is great, it's a real page turner. And it's only like several hundred pages later that someone tells him it's an allegory for the Russian Revolution. And, you know, it turns out he just thought it was a book about particularly intelligent pigs.
And I don't remember that.
But that's, I think, great. There's something so interesting about that. So when I first went into it, I was actually quite determined not to have direct corollaries between particular characters and particular politicians. But then I realized actually there is, in a weird kind of way, you achieve general truth through precision. Mm. It's like that old thing of, you know, if you try to appeal to everybody, you end up appealing to nobody. And so I allowed myself to tack pretty close to certain characters at certain moments. But also a lot of the underlying structure comes from the fact that there are patterns to the way democracies decay and corruption enters in. So, you know, the election of Trump and the Brexit vote are, in one sense, two very different historical moments. And yet I don't think it's incorrect either to draw parallels between certain events and certain processes and certain technologies, for example, that led to these events. So this comes back to the artistic purpose of the book. If there came a moment where, let's say, one particular character is relatively close to Boris Johnson, if there came a moment where this character needed to do something to depart from the Boris Johnson line, then in order to serve the book, as I saw it, then I would allow them to do that.
I think maybe one thing, weird thing about a lot of the politicians of the last few years is that they almost seem like types, mm-hmm. in a way, Johnson or Farage or Corbyn. And so they seem to lend themselves very well in a way that, I don't know, like Jeremy Hunt. Uh-huh. Does not seem to be crying out to appear in a novel or an allegory or anything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But we have had these really big and in some kind quite grotesque characters.
Yeah, I think, so you take someone like Trump, for example, he was already allegorized before he came about in novels like It Can't Happen Here. Like that was a strange moment when he was elected. Yeah. People looked, I mean, a little bit less, but in like Philip Roth's The Plot Against America as well, there was already this whole almost genre of American literature that predated Trump, but that seemed to allegorize his arrival in power. I did struggle because, as I say, I had a bit of a plague on all your houses kind of approach. And what I really didn't want to do was for people to read this book and say, okay, there's clearly a guy with, you know, broadly center-left opinions who was probably shaped, you know, in the 1990s as a teenager and felt the optimism of New Labour and hasn't quite got over that. And because I found an enormous frustration with how the center ground, like where I find my political home to be, have acted over the last few years. But as you say, it's difficult to find types that fit with them and to find patterns to their behavior. And I think the thing that I landed on was this sort of, I guess, an emotional blindness of the left, like this refusal to understand that of the center left, this refusal to understand that, yes, yeah, so a lot of politics was about emotion and the gut and just sort of plowing on with this idea of rationality, I guess.
When we start the book, Buttercup is in charge of the farm and he is the status quo.
Yes.
Like not necessarily like Tony Blair or David Cameron, but he is the status quo, isn't he?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And you're
very
sort
much.
Of like, when you see the people that sort of want to take over the farm, there's some sympathy towards him, but also these giant flaws and miscalculations.
Yes. A lot of the plot, in a sense, was reverse engineered. Like I knew where I wanted to get to, but I wasn't entirely sure when I first started writing where I was going to start. So where I wanted to get to, there were a few scenes from recent years which stuck with me. So there was the faces of Boris Johnson and Michael Gove the morning after the Brexit vote.
Oh, yeah.
Just their look of sort of almost sort of disbelief and this weird kind of desolation. There was Trump's inauguration and the whole American carnage speech and the iconography, the sort of pseudo-fascist iconography he surrounded himself with. And I knew that the feeling I wanted to get to. And then as I started tracing back, I did say, okay, so, you know, we need to go through austerity. We need to go through the financial crisis. But then I found myself kind of rolling further and further back, probably too, like, you know, the Buttercup, as you say, isn't directly Tony Blair or Bill Clinton or that kind of figure. But I did suddenly find the seeds of a lot of this, I suppose, this decay of this idea of truth or of shared stories or of the reliability of narratives in some of the, well, for want of a better word, shenanigans of like Blair and Campbell in the mid to late 90s.
I should say at this point that the book opens sometime after the events of the original on the farm. There are, you know, callbacks and you know, some characters recur, but a fair bit of time has passed.
Yes, and I allow myself a sort of deliberate vagueness between how it went from Stalinist totalitarianism to kind of, you know, consumer democracy. Yeah. That wasn't so important, I gave myself a bit of leeway.
that's fair enough. Well, you mentioned there the kind of, you know, the bending of truth. And when I reread Animal Farm in 2017, mm-hmm. I found that the theme of what we now call post-truth felt very relevant. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone knows the rewriting of history, the gaslighting of citizens, mm-hmm. someone, is crucial to 1984.
Yeah.
It's almost the thing that people know about 1984. But it's really important in Animal Farm,
yes.
as well. The animals are constantly being told that's not what the rules were.
Yes.
The rules haven't changed. You've just misremembered them.
Uh-huh.
And there's a real almost sort of nightmarish sense of like some of the Orwell describes some of the animals going, sure, it wasn't quite like that, but I guess it must be. And
that felt
very modern. When you reread it, which, given that it is an allegory of a regime from 1917 to 1945, like which bits felt modern to you?
Certainly the violence done to language. I realized that is what had struck me as a teenager when I studied it at school as well. I don't think I really knew about the details of the Russian Revolution. I would have studied it, but I do remember those moments, you know, no animal shall sleep in a bed with sheets. Or, you know, four legs good, two legs bad, being kind of corrupted and changed and feeling each of those as a real gut punch. And that was the thing that in rereading it in order to write this book, I felt again, and I really felt the relevance of that to our contemporary situation. But I think we've gone one step further as well, which is it's not just that these words change now, but almost the facts change behind them, like the effect that these words have on the reality as the animals or as we see it.
And I think something that Orwell would not have been able to see, because he was looking at sort of state control of mm-hmm. information, is something one can see on Twitter, for example, every day, which is that ordinary people are perfectly willing to misuse words, to cite misleading facts, that actually it seems to be a quite common human thing that you don't need a regime to do this. Mm-hmm. People become sort of complicit.
Yeah, I think behind that complicity, there's also a carelessness as well. Everyone has busy lives. People, you know, don't necessarily pay too much attention to the implications of certain words, to where they're getting their information from. You know, that you get the information from I do this as much as anyone else, from the source you feel most comfortable with. You're probably most likely to trust the source which already chimes with your pre-held ideas. And because we're busy, because we're overwhelmed, we sort of carelessly accept them. And that was one of the things that occurred to me in the writing, was that, you know, again, I said it was a plague on all their houses. It's actually a plague on all our houses. Like, I think I had this growing sense of like the individual responsibility of each of us. Now, I don't want to condemn each of us.
You want some of us to buy the book.
Well, yeah. But we were all, let's say, a little bit shit. But then that's not necessarily a bad thing to say, because I think also maybe one thing that allowed me to give at least a glimmer of hope at the end of the book was that if all of us just being a little bit crappy and a little bit careless can lead to the sort of vicious circle and lead to the situation we have, is it naive to think that if we all just became a little bit less crappy, you know, we don't have to make these huge gestures, we don't have to radically transform our lives, but just made a little bit more effort, maybe we could set in motion a kind of a virtuous circle that could improve things.
Can you explain how you represented social media? Because that was one of my favorite bits. And that was one of those bits that felt that so new and yet so in the spirit of the...
Yeah, that was the biggest challenge I had when I first conceived the book, because I think one of the advantages Orwell had was that all of his characters, all of the events existed essentially on the same plane. That's not how we live now. We live on, you know, at the very least on two planes. You might say I don't think we really talk in these terms anymore, but the real world and the online world.
Yeah.
But there was definitely a sense that there was this separation and they were these two elements were influencing each other, but they weren't directly connected necessarily in any physical sense. And I struggled to come up with something. And then obviously with all of the ideas that you struggle with, the answer is staring you in the face. And I remember once just, you know, going onto Twitter, seeing the bird logo and realizing that, you know, I could have these two planes. I could have the groundling animals. I could have the pigs and the cows and the alpacas and all the others. And then I could have this murmuration of starlings who arrive on the farm and interact, but also exist in their own raised space and start causing mischief or trouble from this kind of elevated, slightly sort of ungrounded position.
I wanted to get back to where I suppose where we started with a sort of emotional impulse. And Margaret Atwood once said that as a child, even though she knew nothing about Stalinism and probably like John Selfie Money didn't understand what the book is about, she cried when Boxer died, and that was what stuck with her.
Yes.
Now I found, no spoilers, there was some real emotional gut punches in Beasts of England as well, where I was genuinely like, oh, bloody hell.
Yeah.
Was that tragic dimension important to you as something that was both fundamental to Animal Farm and very important to the kind of satire, if you want to call it that you're doing, that is not that sort of, you know, glib surface satire?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, in the early drafts, some of my early readers, that was a thing that several of them pointed out, that for them, they didn't find there was necessarily what might be called the Boxer moment.
Mm.
But it's a bit more complicated, I think, these days to have that moment, because I'm a great admirer of Orwell. I think where one of his blind spots is a tendency sometimes to romanticize the working class.
Mm.
And the trouble is when you romanticize a group of people, you decomplexify and to a certain extent dehumanize them. And I think he does fall victim a little bit to that with Boxer. I think Boxer has the sort of the romanticized, hardworking, credulous, naive working class. I think I had to be a little bit less direct with which animals represented certain classes, because again, you know, the way we look at society has changed. Yeah. And then again, you know, without any spoilers, I thought of the moment during the Brexit referendum when Joe Cox was murdered. And I thought two things about that. Firstly, about what are just an absolutely harrowing and sort of politically devastating and personally devastating event that was for, I think, obviously for her family, but also for British democracy, that could happen at that moment. And also then in the days that followed it, there's that horrible feeling of, and this isn't going to change anything. Like, people aren't going to take a few steps back and say, maybe this rhetoric has gone too far. I mean, like, it just, there was a pause in the campaigning and then everything just went on as before. And I realized that if there was going to be sort of an equivalent of the kind of the Boxer moment, and I think there are not just one, there are maybe several in the book, but that it had to be of that kind of caliber.
And even though the themes are not cheering, you know, because of the nature of it, was it a fun book to write? Was it even cathartic? How much pleasure did you get out of creating these characters, playing with Orwell's legacy, and fixing those problems as you went along?
I think it's probably the most enjoyable thing I've ever written.
Oh, that's good to hear.
I think for two reasons. Firstly, because just writing something with talking animals is something I never considered before. And it allowed me to sort of expand into, I guess, a non-realist, non-human space But it was also important to me that the book be fun to read. I think particularly when I realized that it was going to be longer than Animal Farm, because it had to be, that maybe, you know, adult readers have a certain patience threshold for talking animals, and maybe Orwell had got it just about right. And so if I was going to make it, you know, 1.5, almost 2 times as long as his book, then it had to be funnier and it had to be entertaining. I also think that's more my natural aesthetic. Like, I was raised on the sort of, in the wake of the sort of alternative comedy of the early 80s. And so that, you know, was shaped as much by The Young Ones and Viz and things like that as by literature. I believe in the fundamental seriousness of comedy and of the absurd. And I think just because a book is funny doesn't mean it's serious. And in fact, I would go as far as to say I have difficulty sometimes taking a book that isn't funny seriously.
That's a very, to come back to Martin Amis, that's a very Martin Amis approach.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining me, Adam Biles.
Thank you for having me.
Beasts of England is out now, published by the excellent Galley Beggar Press. And you can hear Adam interview authors on the Shakespeare and Company podcast. And thanks to you for listening to The Bunker. If you enjoyed our conversation, please help spread the word by telling a friend, sharing it on pesky social media, or reviewing us on iTunes. You can also support us on Patreon, where you'll get episodes early, without ads, and with bonus goodies. Take care and see you soon.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof, or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker was presented by Dorian Linsky and produced by Kasia Tomashevich. The assistant producer is Adam Wright, social media by Jess Harpin, art by Jim Parrott, and audio production from me, Robin Lieber. Managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, group editor Andrew Harrison, and our music is by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.